Joining me on the line is Thomas Greco. Thomas is a community and monetary economist, educator, writer, and consultant. He is a former tenured college teacher who has spent more than 30 years studying and writing about ways to achieve greater harmony, equity, and sustainability through business and economics. His special expertise in monetary and financial structures has led to innovative designs for private community currencies and payment systems. He is the author of numerous books, and his new book is entitled The End of Money and the Future of Civilization. Thomas, good to have you on the show.
Yeah, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
We are in your debt. Seeing we're talking about money. Right. Over the next hour, you have the opportunity, and together we have the opportunity to educate the people here in Ireland and worldwide as to the functioning of the money system. We have interviewed a couple of people, including Bill Still, about the money changers and the money system in the past. What you offer in the way of being different is a solution. So, how did you first get involved in the solutions side of this? What really led you up to doing what you're doing now? And indeed, what was your background?
Well, my early background was in engineering. I was in aerospace engineering for a few years and then went to graduate school in business. And when I finished that, I started my academic career teaching in a business college in the eastern part of the United States. Midway through that, I did some additional graduate work and working toward a PhD. And in that time, I had an opportunity to get involved with the human potential movement. And in some inexplicable fashion, it really changed my life. I went through a period of emotional difficulty and catharsis, and came out the other end with a newfound appreciation for the difficulties that so many people have to contend with in the world. So social justice became an important motivating factor in my life.
Okay.
And as a result of that, I got involved in the peace and justice movement and the decentralist movement and various other movements that you might describe as progressive. And in the course of that, I began to do some research into the root causes of poverty and war and all of the difficulties that seem to beset humanity. And what I quickly discovered was that the system of money and banking that has developed over the last 300 years or so is extremely dysfunctional and is a root cause of all of these difficulties. So I set out to try to understand as deeply as I could what the nature of that system was, what the dysfunctional aspects might be, and how they might be remedied. Basically, I concluded that the system is beyond repair. It cannot be reformed. What we have to do is to find ways to transcend it. And so that's what I've been writing about. As you say, I've written four books on the subject. The first one appeared in 1989, and it was called Money and Debt, a Solution to the Global Crisis. And that was my first attempt to describe the dysfunctional nature of the money and banking system. And in that book, I also laid out some basic principles upon which a better exchange system could be based. And then I followed that up in 1994 with a second book called New Money for Healthy Communities. This was influenced largely by my work in the decentralist movement and my realization that we needed to decentralize and downscale our institutions. So in that book, I described historical precedents of alternative exchange systems and local currencies and scrip issues of the Great Depression and LEP systems as they were emerging at the time. And then in 2001, The next book was called Money, Understanding and Creating Alternatives to Legal Tender. That was essentially an expanded, updated, and improved version of the previous book. And again, it described historical precedents and examples of alternative exchange mechanisms, and also elaborated some of the principles that need to be applied in developing effective exchange alternatives. Just last year, my latest book came out, The End of Money and the Future of Civilization, and that book is takes a comprehensive look at the problem of money, the money problem as I call it, and it outlines prescriptive moves that can be taken by various entities, businesses, NGOs, governments, especially local governments, to create exchange alternatives that do not suffer from the defects of the dominant money and banking paradigm. So in the last year or so, I've been doing a lot of speaking and talking. I was before that, but since the newest book came out, and since we've had this financial meltdown that occurred in 2008, people are really clamoring for answers, and I've had to respond to a lot of requests to speak and to elaborate on the material in my books.
Well, here's an opportunity now for you to expand on the work of some of the different researchers and authors that have also highlighted the problems and indeed the mechanisms of the money system. If you could you simplify the system insofar as actually how does this system work currently, and how has it evolved over the last 300 years by the money changers, money lenders?
In my book, I describe how money has evolved over time, and we use the word rather loosely and confuse ourselves because it has different meanings. Many times when people talk about money, what they're actually talking about is wealth. And wealth and money are two different things. Wealth can take many different forms. Money is specifically a medium of exchange. It's a mechanism for facilitating trading of goods and services. And so when I talk about the end of money, I'm really talking about the end of the political money system and the evolution of money from commodities like gold and silver and other commodities that have been used in the past as exchange media to credit money, which is the kind of money that we have today, to credit clearing. And when I talk about the end of money, that's mainly what I'm talking about, the evolution of the exchange process to direct credit clearing amongst buyers and sellers without the use of banks and without the use of political currencies. So the way the system works today is that all the money is basically credit. And the way I put it is we give our credit to the banks and then we beg them to lend some of it back to us and pay them interest for the privilege. So basically money is created when banks make loans. That's the factor of the matter, pure and simple. If there were no loans made by banks, there would be no money. The banknotes that we carry in our pockets, you know, your Irish pounds, British pounds, U.S. dollars, euros, those notes are simply physical manifestations of money that was created by banks in the process of making loans. And the way that comes into circulation is when you go to a bank and you say, give me cash, they will basically draw it out against your bank deposit, your account. So most of the money exists as bank deposits, your checking account and mine. But it all came into existence when somebody borrowed from a bank. Now, the bank just created that money on the basis of some collateral, and hopefully it would be sound collateral that had some value. This is the process called monetization. Banks monetize the value inherent in the collateral assets. So, for example, you go to a bank and you say, I would like to borrow money against my farm. And the bank will say, okay, let's evaluate what that farm is worth, and they will give you a loan for some fraction of that value. And if you're unable to repay the loan, then they will confiscate the farm and sell it on the market to recover the money, supposedly, that they loaned you. Okay. But keep in mind that the banks really didn't give you anything. All they did was qualify you as a suitable borrower, and then they created the money and put it in your account. So that's the way money goes into circulation today. It's when banks make loans. And people have a hard time grasping this concept because it is so simple. John Kenneth Galbraith, one of the foremost economists of the past century, said, the process by which money is created is so simple that the mind is repelled. And indeed, that's what I find when I go around talking to people and giving presentations. They just have a hard time believing this, but that's the way it is.
It is a simple process. Now, we've been on the trail of unraveling this process for a while, and my mind rejects the simplicity all the time. So here's a question for you. Who actually initiates the money creation process?
Well, the money creation process involves a borrower and a bank lender. So it's the borrower, prospective borrower, who initiates the process. As I say, for example, you might go into a bank and say, I need some money. Would you give me a loan and I'll put up my farm as collateral? And quite often, banks will make loans on the basis of other collateral. Sometimes it's good collateral, sometimes it's not. So that's the way it works. You have to have willing borrowers and willing lenders. Now, one of the problems today, after the financial difficulties of the last couple of years, is that banks are unwilling to lend to small and medium-sized businesses. So we have the small and medium-sized businesses, the productive sector, being starved for credit, for money, while at the same time banks are willing to lend to governments because they consider government to be a safer investment than an individual producer. And so we have lots of credit being lavished on governments, and we have the productive sector being starved for capital. What we need to do is to find a way to get around this credit monopoly that's enjoyed by the banks. Now, let me go back in history a little bit to explain how this system emerged and what is dysfunctional about it. It's not only the fact that credit is monopolized by a banking cartel, it's also the fact that the system gives preferential access to central governments in taking value out of the economy. Now, the Bank of England is probably the best example of the model that emerged for central banking back in 1694. At that time, King William III was on the throne in England, and he was fighting a war against France. And in those days, money was primarily in the form of precious metals, gold and silver. And war is a very expensive proposition. The king needed money to pay for the war. And so William Patterson and some of his cohorts came to the king and said, we will give you the money you need to fight the war if you will give us a privilege. And that privilege was the privilege of issuing banknotes into circulation by making loans. So instead of lending gold, the bank actually created money in the form of banknotes, and they were given a monopoly on the banknote creation. This was maybe not the first central bank, but it's the quintessential example model of a central bank. And this model has spread all over the world. in the subsequent period. Started in the United States right after the Revolutionary War, when Alexander Hamilton proposed the first Bank of the United States. And it was modeled after the Bank of England and intended to serve the same purpose. Basically, it created two parasitic elements in the economy. First of all, it enabled banks to create money by making loans, that is, by allocating credit, and to charge interest on that credit. Secondly, it allowed governments to borrow money virtually without limit, and so the result of banks lending money to government and government running perpetual budget deficits, as they have in the United States, is inflation, which means a debasement of the currency. So the two parasitic elements, inflation, money that's created simply with two ledger entries, and the inflation that results from government borrowing year after year after year, these are draining the economy of value before we even get to see any money.
Okay, Thomas, can I jump in here for a second?
Let me just say one more thing about the dysfunctional aspects.
Go for it.
The fact that money is created by banks when they make loans and interest is attached to those loans causes a debt imperative. Debt must grow according to the compound interest formula, which is an exponential function. That means it grows at an accelerating rate. So we're all in debt to the banks, or many of us are, and that debt grows simply with the passage of time according to compound interest. And in order for the debt to be paid, new debts need to be created. So it's sort of like a Ponzi scheme. The old debts can be repaid only if the banking system creates additional debts, which are due in a more distant future period. So that provides the money for the old loans to be repaid. So if you look at the statistics, you can see how total debt in the world has been increasing exponentially, that is, at an accelerating rate over the past 700 years. And government debt in particular in the United States, if you look at it, has been accelerating at astounding rates over the last 2 or 3 years. We're now running budget deficits on the order of $1.5 trillion, and those deficits are projected to continue at those levels for the indefinite future. And official government projections on these things are always understated, so we know it's going to be worse than they've said it's going to be. Yeah. So we have built into the system a growth imperative, a debt imperative, which results in a growth imperative. So as those that are in debt to the banks try to avoid defaulting on their loans, they need to increase their sales. They need to increase their control over their markets. We're talking about corporations now. And so we have a continual exploitation of natural resources and despoliation of the environment. And we have the caustic effects of money, this money system, seeping into cultures in every corner of the world and eroding the social fabric as well as the destroying the environment. So growth cannot continue forever. Economists are always talking about growing the economy. Well, we've reached the limits to growth, and we live on a finite planet. The physical limitations of growth are now beginning to cause the financial system to melt down. As long as there were frontiers and there was additional resources that could be exploited, this financial system could continue, exploitative and unfair as it is. But now we've reached the physical limits of growth, and we have to move toward a steady state economy.
So I believe it was under Franklin that the United States at one stage printed their own money or script. Yeah?
Well, I think what you're referring to is the Lincoln Greenbacks during the Civil War in the mid-1800s.
Okay, so can you tell me what happened then and how did that work?
Well, we had central banking in the United States. As I said, Alexander Hamilton and some of his cohorts replicated the Bank of England system in the First Bank of the United States and then later on in the Second Bank of the United States. And this was a major political issue during the Jackson administration. Andrew Jackson was elected president in 1828, and during the campaign for his second term in 1832, the central bank became a political issue, and Andrew Jackson was adamant against the central bank. He recognized that it was the creation of a money power that that was vying with the political power, and he said, are we going to have a government of the people represented by its political representatives, or are we going to have a government by the bankers and unelected people in the financial sphere? So the act to recharter the Second Bank of the United States was passed by Congress, but Jackson vetoed it, and that killed the central bank for some period of time until the Civil War. Now, that was an interesting period because in the interim, we had an era called the free banking era, pejoratively referred to sometimes as the wildcat banking era, in which we had no central bank. We had multiple banks in competition with one another, and they were creating money on the basis of loans as well, but there was no banking monopoly. And this was a period of tremendous growth in the United States because credit was readily available for productive purposes. Now, surely there were abuses, but the abuses actually resulted in difficulties for the banks that were abusing the money creation privilege because it was not a centralized system. And those banks that abused their issuing privilege eventually went out of business. But when the Civil War was being waged, Abraham Lincoln had a similar problem to King William in that war is expensive and governments need to raise money to fight wars. He went to the bankers to get loans, but the bankers were willing to lend only on very high interest. And so Lincoln went to some of his advisors, and one of them recommended that Abraham Lincoln ask the Treasury to issue banknotes directly and to spend them into circulation. And these were the famous greenbacks, as they were called, because they were notes that were printed in green on the reverse side. So many hundreds of millions of dollars worth of greenbacks were printed to pay the soldiers and to pay the suppliers for the war material. And that got around the bankers. It saved the government a lot of cost in terms of interest. But that is not a long-term solution to the problem. Many people today are recommending that we ask the government to issue money directly instead of having the banking system created. But I'm not in favor of that because I don't think it's going to change anything. Government has become so thoroughly under the control of the banking and financial interests that even if the Treasury were to issue money directly, it would serve the bankers' interests, and they would do it in a way that would serve their interests. Secondly, it doesn't get around all of the problems with the money system. The reason why greenbacks were able to circulate and to be used as money is because they were compelled by legal tender laws. Now, in those days, money was still basically gold and silver. Banknotes were issued also, but they were redeemable for gold and silver. Now, governments, when they issue their own money, they're basically taking loans from the general public. And if they exceed their capacity to repay, then basically they're debasing their own currency. And people will recognize that, and if they are given a choice, they will either refuse to accept that money or they will accept it at a discount, maybe 80 cents on the dollar or 50 cents on the dollar. Now, governments don't like that, so to prevent people from freely discounting government currency, they pass legal tender laws. And legal tender says you must accept this money in payment of debts. And if you read the inscription on a Federal Reserve note, for example, it says this note is legal tender for all debts, public and private, which means that you have no choice about accepting it, no matter to what extent that currency is debased. Now, we've seen many cases of governments abusing the issuance privilege. One example that I write about in my latest book is Weimar Germany between World War I and World War II. The German government printed its own notes in such huge quantities that the currency basically became worthless. People were getting paid twice a day, and they were spending the money as fast as they could before it lost further value. And notes were being printed in denominations of millions and billions of marks. Same thing is going on today in Zimbabwe. And that happened as well in the United States until the greenbacks were given legal tender status. Now, Salmon P. Chase was a member of the cabinet during Lincoln's administration. He was the Treasury Secretary, and he presided over the issuance of the greenbacks. Later on, he was made Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, and a case came before the court that related to this legal tender status of the greenbacks. And in a split decision, the court ruled that the legal tender law was legitimate, but Chase, who had presided over the issuance of the greenbacks, dissented on that opinion. And he said, quote, "The legal tender quality is only valuable for the purposes of dishonesty," unquote. And that's my position on the matter as well. If governments want to issue currency, that's all well and good, but they should not compel the circulation of that currency. The currency should be able to stand on its own 2 feet as a credit instrument, and people in the market should be free to refuse it or discount it.
Okay, what's to stop me from going down to my neighbor with maybe a pound of fresh, tilled, organic, high nutritional content soil and exchanging it for, say, I don't know, a liter or a pint of organic milk?
Well, there's nothing to stop that at all. That's traditional barter.
Yep.
It's one valuable thing for another valuable thing.
Yes.
You know, when we talk about the evolution of the exchange process, what we're talking about here is reciprocal exchange, where you expect to get as much as you give. We're not talking about gifts here. We're talking about reciprocal exchange. You get as much as you give as much as you get. So, barter, of course, is the way this has been done for ages. However, barter has a limitation. It's inconvenient. That's why we invented money in the first place. In order for a barter transaction to take place, you need to have something I want, and I need to have something you want. If one of us has nothing the other wants, then there can be no barter transaction. What we need to do is to open up the process to include others so that I can give you what you want and get what I want from somebody else in the community. So as soon as we do that, we're beyond barter. We're doing something else. We need to have a medium of exchange that enables this process to take place. Now, in the early days, the exchange of media became basic commodities that were in general demand. So, historically, we've seen things like hides and salt, sugar, bullets, nails, various other things that have been used as the exchange medium. And ultimately, of course, precious metals became preferred because they had certain properties that serve the purpose very well. But it's still a barter transaction. If I give you a piece of gold for your eggs or your soybeans, it's still one commodity for another. It's still a barter transaction. But since the gold is in general demand and generally valued, it serves the purpose quite well. However, we don't use gold and silver as money anymore. We use credit. We have a system of generalized credit that's controlled by the banking system. So we can get around the banks by organizing ourselves into a credit clearing union, for example. Probably a lot of your listeners are familiar with LETS. LETS is a grassroots attempt to do this. A number of people get together, form an association, and they agree to transact business without the use of conventional money. They simply keep a ledger of accounts. When you sell something to someone, your account is credited, that is, it goes up. And when you buy something from someone, your account is debited, that means it goes down. So basically you have an account balance that fluctuates. It goes up when you sell, it goes down when you buy. The idea is that in the long run, it's going to fluctuate around zero. Sometimes you'll be in the positive, sometimes in the negative. But the fact is, by allowing negative balances, we are, in effect, creating our own money. You can think of it as a money system. Because, as I said before, today, all money is credit. But we allow the banks to monopolize the credit. So here, by organizing a LETS system, or to speak generally about it, a mutual credit clearing system, we use our own credit within our own community to mediate the reciprocal exchange process.
You're listening to The Irish Side of the Moon. You can hear our new episodes every Monday on radiomedia.org and irishsideofthemoon.blogspot.com. You can also download episodes from iTunes, Stitcher, and many other sites. You can follow us on Twitter, you can join our Facebook group, and if you're already in the group, don't forget to invite your friends. If you have any ideas for future guests on the show, send an email to shane@theirishsideofthemoon.ie. We are Irish Side of the Moon, freedom of information, personal empowerment.
Okay, so there's currently programs like LETS running on the planet. Can you talk to us about those, please?
Yeah, LETS has a history of about 25 years now. It was originated by Michael Linton in British Columbia, Canada. I think around 1982 was when he set up his first LETS system. And it became very popular and proliferated rapidly around the world. So we have 25 years of experience with LETS systems, and the experience has been mixed, and there are a number of reasons why it hasn't been more successful, and I elaborate those in my book. But let me say a word about other credit clearing systems. This was not a new idea. This credit clearing process between buyers and sellers goes way back in history. It's been done before. LETS is simply a modern reinvention of this process. But it's not the only one. In the commercial realm, we have commercial barter exchanges, so-called, which don't really do barter. They do credit clearing. They're more properly called trade exchanges. So there are companies that do this on a for-profit basis. Companies like BarterCard, ITEX, IMS. There are hundreds of them around the world. In the United States and UK and Europe and elsewhere. And basically these are companies that arrange for non-cash trading amongst established businesses, largely at the retail level. So let's say I operate a trade exchange. You happen to run a restaurant. So I come to you and I say, why don't you join our trade exchange, and you can get what you need from our members without using your precious cash. What you do in return is to provide restaurant meals to our members, again, without the use of cash. So it's a debit and credit system, and some of our members will be given a line of credit so that their accounts can go negative. That means they can buy before they sell. And this is basically the money supply, the outstanding obligations of those with a debit balance, whether it's a LET system or a commercial trade exchange. It's those negative balances that constitute the supply of exchange media. So LET systems have proliferated. Typically, they have been on the fringe. They haven't involved mainstream businesses. And this is one of the reasons for their limited success. They've been based on ideological foundations rather than on economic necessity. So it's been people with some understanding that there's something wrong with the dominant monetary and economic paradigm organizing LET systems to empower themselves. But because they have not involved enough of the mainstream business community, the available goods and services within a LET system is typically limited, and people do it as an avocation rather than as their main business line. Yeah. Also, they've not achieved sufficient scale of operation. A credit clearing system is useful only to the extent that it includes a large number of goods and services and a large number of traders. So that's been the problem with LETs. Also, another problem with LETs is many LET systems have not put limitations on debit balances. You cannot allow any particular member to continually take without giving. This creates a drag on the system. If they buy and never sell, this creates a lot of credits out in the system that people find they're unable to buy anything with, or not buy enough with. So people get discouraged and they stop trading. Right. In the commercial side of it, this has been better managed because they realize that if they put out too much credit on any one account and there isn't adequate reciprocity exercised in a timely fashion, the same thing is going to happen. Trading bogs down. So you have to have limitations on the balances in the accounts and not allow any account balances to become excessive in relation to their capacity to provide goods and services.
Okay, a big question would be, Tom, what do you see as a solution for the fair and equitable exchange of goods, services, and resources that we can employ as human beings on this planet?
Well, I think in terms of moving to a steady-state economy, basically what we have to do is to organize ourselves to reclaim the credit commons. Now, the credit commons, what I refer to as the credit commons, is the credit that we give to one another. As I said earlier, the credit has been monopolized by the banking cartel, and we've allowed that to happen. So all money now, even political government money, is basically based on your credit and mine. It's our willingness and legal compulsion to accept it that gives it value. So we have to reclaim the credit commons. We have to carve out a portion of the credit to allocate ourselves directly to one another. And we do this by reorganizing the exchange function. As I said, we need to monetize the value added by local producers. by creating these direct credit clearing, mutual credit clearing exchanges. But looking at the bigger picture in terms of moving to a more equitable economy and a steady state economy, we have to recognize that the dominant economic paradigm is based on certain beliefs and concepts, what we might refer to as the old world order. It's based on a belief in scarcity, that there isn't enough to go around, based on a belief in the immutable and sinful nature of humans, belief that violent conflict is inevitable. It's based on command and control methods of imposing order, and it's based on a belief that only an elite is wise enough to rule. Now, the New World Order that politicians have been talking about for the last several decades is simply an extension of that. It's an order that centralizes power and consolidates wealth in the hands of a few. And the New World Order that the politicians are talking about is simply an order in which national governments are weakened, national sovereignty is undermined, and control shifts over to multinational corporations, mainly in the hands of global financial and political elite. Now, what we need to do is to move toward what I call a convivial new world order. And that's a world order that favors diverse, decentralized, small-scale systems and communities. And it's based on a different set of beliefs. It's based on a belief in abundance and sufficiency, that there is enough to go around. It's based on the collective intelligence and community self-government, that people are wise enough when they put their heads together to govern themselves and to solve their problems. It's based on the idea that humans have a potential for improvement. Human nature is not fixed and sinful. It's based on the belief that we can have nonviolent conflict resolution. We don't have to fight a war every time there's a disagreement. And it's based on a belief in distributive justice, that everybody deserves to get enough of the basics to have a decent life. So in order to achieve that, you know, we have to change our minds, first of all, but we also have to change our structures. I talk about three levels. We have to change at the personal level, that is the mind change. We have to give up some of our cherished notions and beliefs and open our minds to accept something better. Once we do that, we can begin to heal our relationships. That's the interpersonal dimension. And then based on all of that, we can create new structures that better serve our needs. New structures of money and banking and exchange, new structures of finance, new structures for production and distribution.
Okay, it sounds like you're talking about a human revolution from the inside out and from the ground up.
Well, yes, but I think that's going on. I think nature has a way of causing things to evolve, and human consciousness, I think, is evolving along with everything else. So we've seen a lot of development over the last several decades in the way people think, and the values, I think, are changing along with that. You know, when I first started doing yoga back in the mid-70s, people, if they knew anything about it at all, they thought it was something weird. Now yoga is everywhere. Everybody's doing it. Also, we've seen a lot of movement toward localization. There's the Transition Towns movement that started in the UK and has spread rapidly around the world. People are realizing that centralizing power and centralizing government just doesn't work very well. That we have to bring things back to the local level, and we have to develop a greater level of local self-reliance And so people are looking how to relocalize agriculture, how to empower local communities, how to do things on a scale that is manageable and bring things under control of people themselves rather than depending on elected officials and distant hierarchies. So I think all of this is happening, and I think the pace at which it is evolving is accelerating. So I'm very hopeful for the future that this is what we're going to accomplish in the next few years. You know, I use the metaphor of the metamorphosis of the caterpillar into the butterfly. We've had for the last several hundred years what I call the caterpillar economy. The behavior of the caterpillar is to eat and to grow, to eat and to grow. And this can be a very destructive process. You can have an infestation of caterpillars that can basically defoliate trees and plants almost overnight. And this growth proceeds at a rapid pace, but eventually it stops. And I think what we're seeing in the global economy now is the signals that the growth economy needs to stop. We need to have better distribution of what we're producing. We need to have a better assortment of production, producing more things that we really need and less of what we don't need. You know, I've traveled a lot in Asia over the last 5 years, and I see that we are awash in a surplus of goods. You go to the markets in cities like Bangkok or Chiang Mai or Penang, and you see all of the stuff being offered for sale. Everybody's trying to sell you something, and it just boggles the mind, all the things that people are making and selling and trying to get a few dollars for. And at the same time that we have this superfluous production, we have people in the world who don't get enough to eat. One-third of the people in the world do not get enough to eat. Many are still dying of starvation and of diseases that could be easily prevented. Many people don't have clean water to drink. They don't have clean air to breathe. And this is an absurdity when you consider that we've solved the production problem. We have no problem producing everything we need, enough for everybody to go around. And we just need to reallocate our priorities.
So we're talking about all the different systems on the planet, health systems, energy systems, environmental systems, economic systems, owned and manipulated possibly, seemingly malfunctioning and dysfunctional, but from the viewpoint of those who run and maintain these systems from the top, they function perfectly for their goals, whatever they may be, even though we see them as dysfunctional.
Surely there are winners in this system, but you know, when you consider the overall effect on the environment, on the social degradation, there are no winners. We all want to live in a place that's safe and clean and healthy, and the more disparity you have in income and wealth, the more crime you have, the more squalor you have. Who wants to live in that kind of an environment? So we have to take responsibility for ourselves within our local communities and work from that base.
Okay, Tom, in the past we've interviewed many people and they've had a different understandings of the Federal Reserve and the American banking system, the North American banking system. Are you familiar with the European Central Bank? Are you familiar with how that interacts with the individual central banks, say, of Ireland? What information do you have about that?
I've not made a specific study of the European Central Bank. But basically, I've concluded that all of the central banks function on the same general basis, and they all collaborate with one another to preserve this this global banking and financial system. In the latest difficulty that's arisen in Greece, for example, we've seen the central banks of the world rally to try to prevent Greece from defaulting on their debts. Now, some of the people here in the United States, notably Congressman Ron Paul, have been asking the Fed to reveal what they've been doing in this regard, but the Fed has refused, which is it's an absurd situation. As you can imagine, we have the central bank that's supposed to be, well, on the one hand, independent of government, but on the other hand, responsible to government, and they refuse to say what they're doing. So operating in secret, how does the ordinary person, how does even our politicians know that what they're doing is effective, is justified and reliable? So all of the central banks basically follow the same model, whether they are nominally owned by the government or privately owned. They basically follow the same model, and they collaborate with one another in order to keep this system going.
Okay, I'm aware that time is catching up with us, Tom. So what suggestions would you make? What things, practical things, can we do tomorrow? Or even tonight, to make an impact on the system so that we can take back our own power?
Yeah, I tell people that they have to invest in the butterfly economy and not in the caterpillar economy. So if we're going to move to a steady state, sustainable economy, and if we're going to realize the values that we have, we have to direct our spending and our investment in the proper direction. So, you know, every time you buy something, you're casting a vote in the marketplace. So look at your spending. Look at what you're buying. If you want to support local agriculture, buy local produce. If you want to support local business, put your savings in a locally owned bank that's going to invest locally, or put your savings into a credit union. If you're going to buy stocks, don't buy stocks in major corporations. Buy stocks in companies that are going to produce things that support the steady state economy, like wind generators and solar cells and renewable energy sources and things like that. But above all, as I said, we have to reclaim the credit commons by organizing mutual credit clearing systems in our local communities. So if there is one, join it. If there isn't one, try to help organize it. But do it on a basis that includes the local business community. We will not get very far unless we have mainstream businesses, particularly locally owned and locally managed businesses, in a credit clearing system. So that's my primary advice. Okay. For more, you can go to my website, reinventingmoney.com, and my blog, beyondmoney.net. That's reinventingmoney.com and beyondmoney.net. I try to keep beyondmoney.net up to date, and reinventingmoney.com is a repository for some of the best materials that I've found on liberating money and banking. Okay, I think you'll find many of the questions are answered on my website and blog. I encourage people to explore those in depth. I have a number of presentations, audiovisual presentations, on my blog, and these are recordings of presentations that I've done over the last few years.
Perfect. 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 Any last words, sir?
I think that does it from this side.
That does it. Okay. Well, go and take care of that throat, and thank you again.
Okay. You're most welcome.
All right, Tom. Take care. Bye-bye.